Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
Hey, this is J. Michael Michael for LA Talk Radio. And if you're like me and you love talk radio, but you just can't find anything worth listening to in the AM dial, then how about this? How about you tune into LA Talk Radio? You see, LA Talk Radio is the biggest and the best in LA, and it's a .com, so we have it all from sports to music to self-help to just about anything, including talk. And right now we have the new writer's favorite show, The Writer's Block. So sit back, grab another glass of wine, open another box of those chocolates, and relax because it all starts right now.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina, Bobby Bell, and Bob Brill, only on LA Talk Radio.
You do like that piece of music.
I do. But you know what? It's really a great opening music.
It is. No, it is.
Yeah. Welcome to LA Talk Radio. This is The Writer's Block. I am your host, Jim Christina, in studio tonight with Bob Brill.
Hey, I'm here.
And we fortunately have lost our third co-host, Bobby Jean Bell. She is called in sick. No, she's called in absent tonight. So she will not be joining us, but we are going to have a good time nonetheless.
Always.
Now, a question, Mr. Writer.
Yes.
Is nonetheless one word or two? Or three?
No, I think it's one word.
I think it is two.
Yeah, it's one word with three pieces.
I actually had an English teacher separate those words once when I was writing.
Really?
Yes. And I said, no. Nonetheless is one word.
I had an English teacher accuse me of plagiarism of something I never read.
Wouldn't it be funny if you got if you got accused of plagiarism of something you wrote?
It was in high school. Serious, Mr. Whatever is Mr. Held. That's what his name was, Mr. Held. Idiot that he was. If he's listening, I hope he's listening because he was a real idiot. And we had this assignment to write, and I wrote this story about a guy in prison who escapes. And I love, you know me, I love irony. And at the end of the escape, he makes this great escape, and he. Or thinks he's going to make this great escape, gets transferred to another cell just an hour before he's going to try it. And it turns out the guy they put in the cell used his escape method and got killed doing it because there was something he missed, right? And he gave me a D. And I said, a D? He wrote on there, you plagiarized. I said, what did I plagiarize? He said, you plagiarized The Count of Monte Cristo. And I said, what? What's The Count of Monte Cristo? I'd never read The Count of Monte, never even seen the movie at that
point. Isn't that Dumas? Alexander Dumas?
Yeah, Dumas. Yeah. And I was like, how can I plagiarize something I've never read?
Yeah.
You know, and then when I read it later on, and I saw even something, like, it wasn't anything. It just happened to be a guy in prison, yeah. You know.
Wearing a mask.
Yeah. My guy wasn't even wearing a mask. You know, he didn't become rich or anything, and no revenge or anything like that. It's like, what an idiot.
Yeah. Hey, I have to tell you, my realty guy was over again last night.
Yeah.
And I played him on last week's show, the opening, first 10 minutes of last week's show. And of course, what was the first thing he caught? The Game of Thrones and then the 2%. when he heard the 2%, I couldn't stop him from laughing. Something came out like, fat chance, Boko.
Yeah, I bet. You just went up from 6% to 12. I mean, you know.
Exactly. And I think he's probably listening tonight. So,
well, good.
Yeah, if you're listening,
let's get him down to 2%.
Yeah, get me down to 2%.
Well, negotiate. Just make it 2.5.
I'll let you list a house on Monday, like you're going to anyway. So what the hell?
Oh, matter of fact, I know a really good real estate agent.
Do you?
Yeah.
Well, I do too.
She's a real hustler,
Casey.
Pam? No, this is somebody else. If this person doesn't give you the 2.5% or 3%,
he's going to.
I'll make a call for you.
Oh, okay.
I know a guy.
Yeah, you got
actually
a guy?
It's a girl, but
you know a guy. I got a guy. Okay, let's get started. We have a lady here from Vancouver, Canada.
Mm-hmm.
She is a writer and illustrator of. She's written a series of books now. It's a trilogy. It's called Alenia's Song Trilogy, and. Tonight's book that we'll be talking about briefly before we get into her writing skills is Alenia's Song Overture. And it's kind of a dark fantasy. Well, kind of a really dark fantasy. Not that dark. Not Game of Thrones dark. She is wears a lot of hats. She's got a strange mix of a degree in medieval English literature, a misspent youth, fronting alternative punk band. Oh, my God, I got to ask her about that. Punk bands, Mad Seraphim and Stiff Bunnies. How's that for names of bands?
My goodness.
And a career as a childbirth educator and doula informs her work. A doula? I have no idea what that is. These days, when she isn't writing, editing, or drawing, she can be found heading up academia, Duello's Mounted Combat Program at Cornwall Ridge Farm in Langley, B.C., where she swings swords.
Oh, man.
She's a sword swinger.
Wow.
And rides horses for fun and profit. Please, 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 please. Welcome to the Writer's Block. It's Jen Lantels. Oh.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Right.
Hang on. Don't jump in yet. You going to push the button?
I'm going to do it right now.
Okay, do it. There we go. So we can't have you come into the show
without a
round of applause.
That's right. You're a sword swinger.
A sword swinger, yes.
Or, okay, we could just drop the sword and say you're a swinger.
Well, you could.
Or you could keep the sword, just talk about medieval literature.
Yeah. And you're a horsewoman.
Yes.
And she takes the high ground.
Yeah. Well, I gave up horses for Lent, as I said earlier. So I used to get really into horses.
I just didn't feel comfortable sitting on top of something that was bigger than and dumber than me.
Well, actually, they're not that dumb.
Yeah, no, they're dumb.
No.
Yeah, I'm not. I'll do battle with you on that one.
This is a guy who doesn't like horses, and he's telling me they're dumb. What say you, Jen? Are the horses dumb?
Some of them are pretty smart.
Yep.
Who's smarter, a dog or a horse?
Trigger.
Trigger.
Depends on the. In general, dogs know more human language.
Yes.
But, you know, horses have a better memory.
Horses understand emotion.
Well, they may understand emotion, but dogs, doesn't matter. They don't have to have a memory. They're just rote. Whatever you teach them, they're going to do whatever you want.
Not necessarily. Not my dog. If she doesn't want to do it, she looks at you and gives you the paw.
The middle one?
The middle paw. The middle paw? Is there a middle paw? Okay. You're up there in B.C., and you actually have the same... publicist that Bob and I have, Mickey Mickelson, and Creative Edge.
Yeah, I'm Mickey at Creative Edge.
Yeah, yeah, great guy, isn't he?
Yeah, he sure is.
Yeah, and he's just, I mean, he keeps you busy. I know that. He's got me two or three shows, well, two or three, four a month I do. So it's kind of fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. Let's talk a little bit about your, I'm not really sure how to pronounce a lot of these names because my tongue doesn't move in that direction sometimes. I assume that her name is Elena?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. I got that right. Well, how about that?
Yeah.
And she is, why don't you tell us the story of Elena? Because it's kind of interesting. Of course, this is a trilogy. Now, this is the second book in the trilogy? Or the third?
This is the first book.
The first book, okay. Yeah. So why don't you give us a little bit of background about Elena and actually tell us a little bit about what country she's in, because you actually borrowed this country from another writer.
Yeah, well, sort of ended up co-creating it because it deviated a lot from, I think, what he originally intended it to be. But, yeah, it's a shared world. Scott Fitzgerald Gray sort of created the world, and he generously allows me to play in it. It's kind of like writing historical fiction in that you have a little bit of research to do. It's not everything out of the top of your head,
right?
Which is nice. It's nice to have somebody think up all those country names and things like that,
and then remember them.
Well, you know, maps are good.
Well, yeah, maps. Actually, you have two maps in the front of your book, which are phenomenal.
Those are maps. I mean, it's based on the original map that Scott created, and then it was illustrated by my good friend and colleague Mel Anastasio, who, you know, you can tell she was really channeling sort of the maps from Lord of the Rings and the Chronicles of Narnia,
right?
That sort of classic fantasy map when she illustrated it.
Right. This is is it Ilmar?
Yes.
Principality of Brandishir. Wow. I don't know where you come up with these. We have the...
I didn't have to come up with
Well, that. Yeah, the Principality of Arak.
Arak,
yeah. Yeah, and Hulk, and Nine Denu Wood. Oh, my God. It's like I said, my tongue and my lips don't work that way.
It's not as easy as creating the Grand Duchy of Fenwick.
No, the Grand Duchy of Fenwick. The mouse that roared, yeah.
I have to ask you one thing. Is Jim and I were talking before the show about name creation.
Right.
And I love name creation. I get a lot of criticism from it sometimes until I end up explaining it. And then they really criticize me. But you certainly like vowels. Tell us a little bit about your thought process for name creation.
So, for better or for worse, for this in this world, I decided that in the Principality of Arak, a lot of who you are is derived, from the first letter of your name. So, instead of say, passing on the last name of Smith, you tend to pass on the first syllable of your first name. So that's why a lot of the characters start with the letter A.
Mm-hmm.
I realized after the fact that, maybe that was a bit confusing, but it was too late to change it by then. But in general, when I'm creating names for a fantasy world, I sort of channel a particular language for particular groups of people. So, for the Ilvani names, I'm kind of channeling Gaelic and sort of general Celtic spellings and pronunciation.
Okay.
But it's very loose. I'm not nearly as obsessive as Tolkien was about, creating a language to go with it.
Right, right.
I invent words as I need them. So if I need a word in a foreign language, I'll invent it on the spot and
oh, wow.
write it down somewhere and hope I remember to use it again correctly.
And hope you remember where you stashed it, yeah.
Exactly.
Well, it's interesting because I find it fascinating and I think most new writers especially, because that's something you always struggle with. I mean, there's this thing, like when you're writing screenplays, or if you're writing like a TV series, you have to be very careful about the names you use, because I believe it's if there's one person that has the name, you could get sued, but if there's a whole bunch of people that do, it's not a big deal, and creating names, every name practically has been used, except in a case like yours where you're creating these very fantasy names.
Yeah.
I was wondering if there's going to be a response.
Well, no, I was just wondering, as far as is that something you think about when you're creating names, and I say this because there are a lot of new writers listening.
Yes.
And it's always, that's one aspect, when you go into this, you don't think, it'd be tough creating names, I'll just create names, but you really have to be careful with some names you create.
But yeah, I mean, John is overused.
Well, I mean, no.
Yeah.
Whether you use the first name or the last
name. John is overused in life, right?
Well, exactly. That was my point. John is overused everywhere.
And if as authors, if we named as many characters Michael as there are, Michaels in our daily life, it would be confusing for the reader.
Well, everybody would be named Michael, and then the only difference would be their last names.
Yeah.
Except Liam is the number one name.
Liam.
Yeah.
Now I caught the Gaelic in some of your names here, and it kind of stands out. I found myself wondering, now, geez, would I ever make? I mean, my names are so easy to make up when I write, because I mean these are Old West characters,
yeah,
and they all went by handles, and nobody used their real name,
right?
A guy might have been named Charles Gully Winker, but he goes by Stinky. So it's real easy to remember, Sandy and Stinky. I mean,
the characteristics how they got there. You could also throw it if
but
you
in
will.
But in your book, you have Riadne and Nord and Glegnen and Master Carolus and Chanis and Darus. And, I thank you and God bless you and the God that you worship for putting these names in the front of the book, because otherwise I would have had no idea who anybody was.
And thank you for not hiring me to do your audio book.
Well, I'll probably, if I ever do an audiobook, I'll probably have to narrate it myself.
There you go.
So just for the pronunciation.
Give us a little bit of the story on your book here, and maybe where the trilogy is going to go from here.
All right. So it's a buildings roman. So it's the first book is really especially the story of how this girl becomes a hero. So, you know, the tradition of the German buildings roman was just how a young person develops into the adult they become. And so that is the story of Elenia. Now, the thing with her is that at around the age of 7, she finds out that she can sing music into magic. And she finds this out when she nearly kills her baby brother by accident by singing a lullaby so that he falls down a trap door. Which gets her in a fair bit of trouble to start with. So it's a skill that is not exactly illegal, but it's highly frowned upon, especially by her family. And it's something she has to hide. So that is a big part of her character, learning to use this power without exposing herself and without hurting anybody in the process. However, there are two other parts to the book, and those are the stories of her mother and her grandmother when they were younger women. So the story of her mother is a love story. It's how she was on her way to her wedding, was ambushed by raiders, and then the story takes place over the course of the 2 weeks that she went missing and then mysteriously turned up again safe and sound. For her wedding day. The story of her grandmother is more like a political saga. Mm-hmm. So her grandmother was a gypsy who fell in love with a prince, and he fell in love with her. They married. They created a supposed title for her so that she could marry him. But her talent is the ability to see the future. However, it's an unreliable talent. So she sees it in bits and pieces, not in order, not always clearly. And she is always trying to manipulate events to either help the things she's seen or prevent the things she's seen from happening. And so her fingers are sort of in the pot of the larger political landscape.
Mm-hmm.
So these stories take place simultaneously, even though the mother and grandmother stories were in the past relative to Elenia. So we kind of ping-pong back and forth between them, and they sort of dovetail at the end of the first book. And then the second book is more just about Elenia, and it's more of a it's more of an adventure story. She's on the road. She's looking for her real father. She gets into all kinds of trouble. Although we do still, you know, touch base again with Loraysa and her Dane, her mother and grandmother. And then the third book, which is not due out until next year, sort of brings it all back together again and brings back the sort of larger political element that's going on in the world and offers up some hard choices for Elenia, as well as their Dane and Larissa to make.
Well, as I told you the other night, it's an interesting read, but it's a hard read, especially if you're not used to reading fantasy, and I'm not. So it's like I find myself drifting and then having to yank myself back into the story and then get across another character that I have no idea who that is, so I have to go back and look, and it's bouncing back and forth. And as you told me the other night, that's why I put the names in front of the book, so you know, pretty much know who everybody was.
Or cast character.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's but it's an interesting premise, and Elenia is quite the young lady. Yeah, as far as that goes. And you have this taking place between 1587 and 1598 in the Imperial Age, somewhere in there, I believe.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the Imperial Age being what?
Well, this is in this world, this land of the Ilmar, which is part of the larger universe, there was an imperial age. There was the people of the Valnarata were in the Ilmar first. The Ilmari came, invaded. Then there was an imperial age, which is sort of an age of high magic, mm-hmm. That ended with a cataclysm. So it was a magical event, kind of analogous to, say, a nuclear war, or it was a catastrophic event.
Mm-hmm.
And so the civilization has sort of started over again. It's been set back. The use of magic has been curtailed to prevent this happening again. But, you know, in terms of where we would be in relation to sort of our history, mm-hmm. You can think about sort of late medieval, early Renaissance.
Yeah, that's what I was kind of thinking. Almost before the Elizabethan era.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm glad you mentioned that because that deals with my next question that I was waiting to ask here, and that is, now you studied medieval literature, is that right?
I did, yes.
Did you have a love for that, and is that love translated into what you're doing here and why you did this here?
I think my love of fantasy literature when I was a kid is what led me into medieval English literature. Mm. And specifically not just medieval English lit, but medieval English romance. So Arthurian romance, the Chrétien de Troyes, things like that. Those were the stories that sort of called to me, as well as, say, the Welsh ones like the Mabinogion. And so I think it was fantasy that led me into medieval literature. And my thesis when I began my doctorate, which I did not finish in Arthurian romance, was on magic in Arthurian romance.
Gotcha. We won't tell anybody you didn't finish your doctorate.
I think you ought to use your book as for your doctorate.
I think so too. I mean, what a great thesis.
Yeah.
You know, it's what, 311 pages of thesis. There you go.
Well, you know, I got started in it on my doctorate at the University of London. And University College London, and then my government back here in BC would not give me a student loan. They said I only needed $13,000 a year to live on in London, which was preposterous. So I quit and I joined a rock band because I figured I could do a doctorate at any time in my life, but I could only be in a rock band when I was young.
Yeah, I noticed.
That's where Jimmy wants to go next.
I caught that. Fronting alternative punk bands like Mad Seraphim and Stiff Bunnies.
Yeah.
Well, it has to be an alternative band with the name like Stiff Bunnies.
Well,
Do tell. Come on. We want stuff.
The guitarist Tommy Emmanuel. I don't know if you've heard of him. He's an amazing classical guitarist.
Uh-uh. You know what? I think I have heard some of his stuff.
Yeah, he's done some. He has had some specials on CBS.
Yeah. And he does a lot of mainstream stuff too.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, he's an acoustic guitarist. He's just amazing. Anyway, we were at a conference, a music conference, and went to a session with him. And he said at the end, you know, we were getting towards the end of the time, and he's like, you know, we're out of time, but Stiff Bunnies. And he gives the two-finger salute, you know, the British two-finger salute. So it was like, and at that point in time, my partner and I were looking for a name for our band, and it's like, that's it. Stiff Bunnies.
Stiff Bunnies. So you were the singer?
I was a singer and a guitarist, yeah.
Oh, good. You play, what do you play, acoustic? Or big
no,
giant?
I play electric.
Big giant ass electric guitar?
No, well, not big giant ass. Regular one.
I just got rid of one, a Stratocaster.
You got rid of a Stratocaster?
Yeah, Stratocaster. Wow. Yeah, nice guitar.
Yeah, sounds like it.
That's Fender. What the Beach Boys play.
Yeah, the only Fender I play is one in front of my car.
You know, we just had, just as a side note, last week we had a lady on. She was, I don't even know how old she was, but she was a great guest.
Yeah, she was.
She booked the acts into the Apollo Theater for years and years and years and years and years. And you know, all the black acts that used to, you know, it was they had to do the Apollo if they were going to go anywhere.
Yeah.
And she was their booker. And it was, like, amazing talking to her about that.
Well, she must have some stories.
Oh, she shared some with us.
Yeah, some we wouldn't expect to hear from.
And then her book was about
sex, and more sex.
And, yeah, it was Chasing Rainbows, NYC, and just gal. I mean, she had so many boyfriends. I think she lost count.
Well, the funny thing was, we asked her about it, and she goes, "Well, it just came out that way.
Yeah,
I'm not a prude.
Yeah,
but.
I'm not a prude, but I just came out that way. I didn't embarrass you, did I? Oh, not us. And you could tell Bobby Jean got a little bit embarrassed, but hey, you know, what can I say? Writing fantasy is, and now I'm gonna, I haven't read anything else that you have written, and I apologize for that, but. Writing fantasy, how much different is that than sitting down and writing a story, say, just a regular romance novel?
It's actually not that different.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's, you know, the setting is different.
Uh-huh.
And it, depending how big a part the, say, magic plays in your story. Those are the plot twist points. But, you know, good stories are about people.
Right.
So it's... regardless of where or when they're set, who the people are, good stories are about people and their relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, my novel, even though it's a fantasy and it's got all these, you know, fantastical elements and imaginary countries in it, is really a story about mothers and daughters. I mean, that's what it is. It's a story about, you know, the lies that mothers and daughters tell to each other and, you know, the things they do for them. And,
uh-huh.
and you know, that is the heart of the story. You know, the rest of it is, you know, a nice setting, just like it's, you know, for me, I like a fantasy setting because it's like having, you know, dinner on the balcony in, you know, a hotel overlooking the Mediterranean as opposed to having dinner in my kitchen.
Sure, sure.
Can be the same dinner,
yeah.
But you know, I like it when it's better when it's on that balcony.
Well, I'm sure you do. And the wine's really good, and
yeah,
the cool breezes.
You can still have the same dinner in your kitchen table, and it's still just as good a dinner, right?
Right.
And that's just the difference for me. You know, that's why I write fantasy. I like that type of setting.
Okay.
Well, you mentioned magic, and of course, when you are writing fantasy, you can pretty much create anything you want and get away with it. But when it comes to magic, is there something special there? I mean, do you have to do you do extra research on what magicians do? And I'm not talking about, I know there's more than just, you know, card shark type magic. But do you do extra research on magicians and the things that they've done over the years and created and different techniques and figuring that maybe a magician may be reading your book?
No, not at all, because it's not the same. It's not the same definition of magic,
right? I
mean, you know, a magician is what magicians do is based purely in reality,
right?
There's no fantasy to it aside from, you know, what you make the audience believe. But fantasy are, you know, is something that truly can't happen or doesn't happen.
Right, right, right. Like it should be spelled M-A-J-I-K instead of M-A-G-I-C.
Yeah, some people do spell that, you know.
Right.
But the main thing I find, I mean, and this is, you know, when I'm reading other fantasy novels, the magic has to be believable. And I don't mean believable in, you know, obviously it's not believable and this couldn't really happen, but it has to have some sort of logic to it. You know, it can't just, and it has to have consequence. So if you have magic, you know, a character ability, it's like a superhero, right? So, you know, if you've got a superhero who has the ability to, you know, leap over single buildings, you know, leap over tall buildings with a single bound, you need to temper that with a weakness, which is why Superman has kryptonite.
Right.
So you have to balance it out. Otherwise, there's no story. And you have to be careful not to make turn magic into deus ex machina. So you don't want to just have problems solved by sudden, unexpected magic. If you're going to have a character's problem solved by magic, then you need to set that up sort of at the beginning of the story. You know, give the reader a hint that this is going to happen, have some reason for this to happen, you know, drop these little hints throughout the story, and then when, you know, when the climax happens and is solved by this magic, the reader is invested in it and has believed in it all along. You can't just sort of spring it on the reader. It's like, well, you know, I just cast a spell and the bad guy disappears.
Right, right.
It's just, that would be totally disappointing.
Yeah, I actually did a scene in a book. It was called The Dark Angel. And the premise of the story is that this demon takes over ministers and preachers that have lost their faith. And this one guy happens to kill his way across the United States and winds up in Arizona. At the end of the book, this kid that's been chasing him all over hell and back, his name is Jeff Stryker, he finally catches him asleep at a brook, at a little creek. Mm-hmm. And he wakes him up, and he's standing there, and he says, come on, get up. And this, now, he knows this thing is different. He knows that he's dark. And he goes, this guy gets up and starts sneering at him. He says, what do you want? He goes, nothing. And he just shoots him. You know? and the guy drops, and all of a sudden this dark cloud comes from him and goes up in the air and starts swirling, and all this debris and leaves and everything are swirling around, and then it's gone. And Stryker looks over, and here's this guy laying on the ground looking at him, mouthing, why? What did I do? You know, he had no clue that he'd been taken over by anything.
Oh, gotcha.
So,
interesting.
Yeah, and I just figured, well, you know, you could actually suspend yourself for just that moment in time.
Right.
So,
yeah.
Anyway, we're going to take a short break, Jen, so don't go away. I'm going to stick you on pause. You'll be able to hear everything that's going on, plus 10%. And we'll be back with you very shortly. Hey, when you open your closet door, do you say, I don't have anything to wear? I do, but Bobby Jean probably doesn't. Or is it time to retire some of those boring shirts? Oh, boy, is it ever. What would you like to see when you open that door? Boots, hats, cool shirts, boho tops, and I still don't know what a boho top is. Out West Shop will revive your wardrobe with fresh looks for men and women, all with great style and comfortable fabrics and for every occasion. So go shop www.outwestshop.com. Enter coupon code SPRING. That would be SPRING. And save $10 on your order. Or call toll-free at 1-877-340-9378 for personal attention. Outwest delivers style door-to-door, coast-to-coast, and around the world. And remember, it's always a great day out west. And that's, of course, Bobby Jean Bell and her husband Jim. They're great, great folks. You want to turn it on, Bob? I can turn you on. I love you, Bob. Hey, J. Michael here for All Dogs Rule. You know, if you're planning a trip and there's no way you can take care of your little canine buddy with you, how about considering All Dogs Rule Day Camp and Sleepover? That is right. All Dogs Rule Day Camp and Sleepover is the premium place for your four-legged friends to spend their time away from you. If you want a place where you know your buddy will be safe and have lots of attention, being able to play with other dogs, goats, sheep, horses, chickens, and more humans, then All Dogs Rule is the place for you. Acres of play space, grass and orange trees, the gorgeous Sespe River, on all with no stress. And extras if you want, just ask. When your dog returns home, you'll have to ask whose vacation was better. So check out their website at alldogsrule.com or give them a call at 805-524-1100. When Creative Edge Publicity was founded in 2016, they immediately showed that they weren't the same as other publicity firms. They work closely with their individual clients' needs and goals and push harder to get them noticed. Creative Edge believes that communication is an important part of the partnership, and that model is how they have built their success. They collaborate and work with local, national, and international media outlets and organizations to meet clients' goals. So Creative Edge, your brand and your future, and Mickey Mickelson and Avery Olive are the publicists. And please give them a holler on the web. You can get them at Creative Edge Publicity. And give Mickey a call. The numbers are right there. And they're great people, and we just love them. And actually, it's Jen's publicist and Bob's publicist and my publicist. Okay, We are back. It is now 7:34 in the studio, and we are on the line with Jen Landis. And Bob Brill is here with me.
Yes.
And is, if you want to call in and talk to Jen, the number here in the studio is 818-602-4929. Again, that number is 818-602-4929. And I'm sorry, it's Jen Dell's, not Landis. I don't know where I got that. Anyway, Jen, question. Yeah. At what point did you decide that you wanted to sit down and write a novel?
I think I always wanted to write a novel, or I think when I was 14, I started writing one.
Uh-huh.
When I was 9, I started writing one, but I never got more than a chapter into that. But it wasn't until I made a lot of starts on novels that I then threw out because I was just too much of a perfectionist and I'd get stuck and this isn't going anywhere. And it wasn't until my daughters were in preschool and I went to a writer's retreat on Bowen Island with Dale Adams Segal, and she has a process called the Hour Stories, which really helped me drop all my perfectionism and just write. And that was when I started actually churning out first draft.
Mm-hmm.
So that was probably about 15 years ago.
Okay. And how many novels you got under your belt now?
I have the three in the Elenia Song trilogy that
right.
are written, but they're not, the third one won't be out till 2020.
Right.
And then I have a series of novellas that I am working on that are set in 17th century France, and they're called The Shepherdess, and it's basically kind of like if James Bond were a girl in 17th century France.
Oh, so.
Interesting.
Yeah. With her Walther PPK stuck in her garter.
A tuxedo.
It's a stiletto in her bodice.
Oh, okay. Well,
that's
we'll go,
even better.
We'll go with stiletto and bodice. I'm easy.
When it comes to perfection, I think you hit the nail on the head. It's such a difficult time to get started if someone is a perfectionist, because you can't sort of get past the first couple of paragraphs. Is that the way you kind of felt?
Exactly. Like, I'd get so far into it and then get stuck because it wasn't right and I couldn't, it wasn't coming out how I wanted it to. So I would stop. And it wasn't until I learned how to just let go and write and not care what came out,
mm-hmm.
because you can always fix it in post.
That's true.
That's exactly right. And that, you know, I tell people that all the time. I say, look, get from point A to point Z.
Right.
Get it down. You can always go back and change. You know, nothing says that you can't change even the basic premise. If you really hate the thing, you could throw it out and start over.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's not like we're carving this on stone tablets.
Exactly. That's right. And, you know, every single book, whether it's crappy or not, has some brilliance in it.
Yeah, no, that's true.
You know, there's somewhere in that book, there's a piece of brilliance. And unfortunately, a lot of writers don't catch that they do throw away a lot of manuscripts and start over. So, but I suppose you can't really base a book on a piece of brilliance.
Well, you know,
no, but it doesn't even matter. You know, there's nothing wrong with throwing out a manuscript.
No, not at all.
You know, that was just practice.
Yeah.
It's like musicians practice
yep.
before they go and play the Albert Hall. You know, athletes train and train and train, you know, before they're ready to get paid pro rates. It's the same for writers. You have to write a lot of lousy words before
right.
you're ready to write brilliant ones.
That's absolutely
true. Or before
you
can write more than a few brilliant ones.
There you go. There you go. When you sit down to write, what is your favorite time to write?
I usually write, I actually write with my co-editors at Pulp Literature,
mm-hmm.
Mel Anastasia and Susan Peters and Jessica Fabricius, and we sit down and do our stories together.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's by Skype and sometimes it's in person, but we write, and that's usually sort of at 10 o'clock in the morning on a Friday, and we'll write for an hour
mm-hmm.
and then read that back to each other, and that forms most of my first draft.
Gotcha. So you only write one day a week?
I write about one day a week, yeah.
Okay.
That's an interesting process.
And then for second and third drafts, you know, those are other days of the week. So,
sure.
You know, while I'm writing one novel in first draft, I'm revising another and I'm polishing another. So
you're actually writing with two other people at the same time?
For first draft, yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah. That's interesting.
And it just, the process is very, I find it very helpful because you time yourself. So you write for 20 minutes and that's the beginning of the scene. And you write another 20 minutes, that's the middle. And you write another 20 minutes, that's the end. And you've just got 20 minutes to get that, you know, each part, beginning, middle, and end out. You get about 1,000 words in an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And there are usually 1,000 good words. So I will, when I go to string it all together into the novel, I will add connecting scenes and, you know, I'll revise and polish. But the gems are almost always the parts that I came up with in those hour story sessions writing
gotcha.
Together.
So when it comes to credit, do they share credit with you?
What's that?
When it comes to credit, do they share credit with you?
No, because we're not writing the same thing.
No, they're all
writing
different
the same
stories.
Time together. Yeah, they're all
they're writing
different things. Yeah.
It's the
pressure of having to churn out enough words that I have something to read back at the end of the hour because we read it back to each other right away.
Right, right.
So it's that pressure that keeps you writing. And then the instant feedback you get when you read it back is fabulous. Because we're not critiquing. We know it's first draft, so we're not criticizing grammar or, you know, logical errors, things like that. We're just looking for immediate reaction. When you're reading it back and it's fresh off the page, you can see when somebody smiles, you can see when they laugh, you can see when they gasp and when, you know, they'll say at the, you know, if it's a really cliffhanger spot, they'll like go, oh my God, that's like, you can't stop there.
Yeah,
and then you know you've hit it, right?
Excellent.
Because you know you've built that tension.
Right, right. Do you write from an outline? You would almost have to because your books are so intricate. Or
I
do you pants it?
I'm a pantser.
God bless you.
I know the ending of my book, but I don't know how I'm going to get there.
Wait, see, that's bugging me. We start, we know how it's going to start, we know how it's going to end, and we let the characters take us to where it's going to go, the logical ending.
Yeah.
A lot of new writers, and I know you're out there, and I know you're listening, and we tell you this weekly, let your brain, let your hands tell the story for you. You know, if you try to stick to an outline, it's really hard, and you usually wind up going off of it. So,
yeah, and that's okay, too.
Of course it is.
As long as you're willing to do that.
Right.
And, you know, some people, I actually admire plotters a lot. I wish I was a plotter because I think I could write faster if I was. You know, I would do less sort of wandering around the countryside trying to figure out what's going on, how I'm going to get from A to B. But it just, I find that for me, plotting kills the energy. And once I've plotted it, I don't want to write it anymore.
Yeah, they see, that's what I found, too. Yeah. That's why I reverted back to pantsing.
Yeah.
I know some of the steps.
But Mel, who I write with every week, she's a plotter, and she's amazing. Like, she writes twice as fast as I do. Like, she'll, at least twice as fast as I do.
Right.
She'll get through, you know, a novella in a few weeks. And it's because she plots it out and she knows ahead of time what the central conflict is going to be, what the turning point's going to be. She knows, you know, what needs to happen. And then, you know, and then I guess for her, the part that flows is she just lets the characters react through it normally.
Right,
so,
right.
You know, there's still a lot of organic, discovery in there.
You're right.
But for her, knowing where she's going, you know, I admire that totally. It's just not something I'm very good at.
I have found also that when you're writing a series of books, and I've written about, I think, 11 or 12 with the same characters, and it's, I mean, in and out, but primarily the same base characters, that they become very real to you. And as you're writing, you know how this guy's going to react. You know what he's going to say. You know how the other person's going to react. And they're all friends now. And it's just, I mean, when you have to kill one off, it's tough.
Yeah.
But you do it anyway.
Because it doesn't hurt you.
Well, not only that, sometimes you need to do that.
Well, yeah.
You know, and you need to bring something to an end because it becomes too familiar.
It becomes too natural. The storyline is done.
Right.
You know, and you can't just fade a character away, especially when he's been a big part of three other stories.
Exactly.
So, you know, I have the hardest time with my sister-in-law because she always, you just killed off one of my favorite people. Well, no, I didn't do it. The bad guy did it, you know?
Yeah.
But it's like they don't understand. A lot of people that are reading and they get mad at you for killing off people, they don't get the fact that when you're writing, it's a totally different deal than a television show. Mm-hmm. This character has outlived his usefulness now.
Yeah.
And he's driven the story only so far. Now someone else has to pick it up and drive it further. So we just get rid of them. We kill them off usually, or they die or move to Alabama.
You don't have to kill them. You can send them to jail.
Yeah. You know. Send them to jail is always good, too.
Yeah, because you can always bring them back later.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
They can redeem or they can be unredeemed.
Right, right.
And if you write superhero fiction, then you know even if you kill them, you can bring them back later.
Yeah, I know. Huh? Superman's been killed how many times?
Oh yeah, who's counting, right?
Yeah. Okay. The question that we have for you is: have you ever had writer's block? And if you have, you only have 2 minutes to answer this. If you have, how did you get out of it, or do you even believe in it?
I kind of don't believe in it. I thought I had writer's block before I started doing the hour stories when I would, you know, get stuck in my own perfectionism. But now that I've discovered these hour stories, I know that anytime I sit down, I can write. And it doesn't mean I know what's going to happen, but I know that I can get through it, and I can just get through it by writing. And sometimes it doesn't even matter. I don't even know before I sit down what I'm going to write. I just have to turn my brain, my critical brain off, let my imaginative brain take over, and something will come out. And it's usually better than I think it's going
to
be.
Yeah, yeah. I've gone to calling writer's block writer's pause.
Yeah.
Because it's like, it's more of I know where I'm going, I just don't know how I'm going to get there.
Yeah, put your brain on hold for a second.
Exactly, exactly. Hey, you know what?
And sometimes you just need to switch tracks, right?
Yeah, yeah, so and I do that.
On something.
You know, a lot
you
of times
go back and revise a scene,
or write a whole new one.
You can polishing or write a different story or something.
Yeah,
and then hop back to it again, and you know, usually you've given your brain some time off to think about it on its own.
I find writing a whole new scene for the same book only further down the road. And then plugging it in where it needs to go. I mean, you get a fresh look at the scene, and while you're thinking about it, you can write it.
Yeah.
And then you know where it's going to go eventually, and then it's already done. You don't have to write it again. It's just plug it in.
Magic of computers.
Hey, we have chewed up an hour, or almost 50 minutes, and we're out of time.
Well, this has been fun.
Well, thank you so much. And if you wouldn't mind telling our audience where they could find you online. And maybe your email address and your Amazon address and, you know, all the above?
Yeah. So I am on Twitter and Facebook. I'm at J.M. Landels. That's L-A-N-D-E-L-S. You can also find me at pulpliterature.com. That's the publisher, and there's a page there, which will also lead you to Amazon and Goodreads and things like that. But J.M. Landels, with an at in front of it, will usually find you to some of my social media.
Excellent. Excellent. Thank you so much for giving up your evening and chatting with us, Jen. It's been great having you, and we appreciate the fact that you gave up an evening for us.
And took us through the fantasy world.
Thanks for having me on.
And taking us through the fantasy world. So there you go. And say hi to Mickey for us. I talk to him all the time anyway, but... But anyway, the name of the book is Alanya's Song. It's Overture by J.M. Landels, and you can find it at Amazon and, of course, all the online booksellers and through your website, I'm going to assume.
All right.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks again for joining us, and have yourself a great rest of your evening.
You too.
Okay, bye-bye.
Here, Jen.
And Jen Landels.
That was fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's I'm not...
smart lady.
Yeah. There was about 20 words in there she used. I have no idea what they were.
Yeah, well, it's, me either, but you never literature. Say that over there.
Medieval literature.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Anyway, next week we have Mark Watson next Thursday. His novel, Death Dresses Poorly. I haven't got into it yet.
But yeah, Russ will be here for that.
And Russell's here for that. And then on Tuesday, we have another special writer's block, the one-on-one with Russ's friend. Actually, he grew up with her and he went to high school with her, Chira Thompson. She's here with her writing partner, and the name of their book is A Time to Wander. It's about it's a fictional story of college students taking off and hitchhiking around the USA in 1970.
Wow.
After Kent State.
Oh, wow. That does sound like an
interesting experience. So I'm kind of thinking that she probably really did that.
Yeah. Personal experience book? Yeah.
Exactly. And you can probably guess what the music for that's going
to
be.
I would think so.
Born to Be Wild, you think?
Yeah, and I'm not going to be here.
Well, just tune in, Bob.
Well, if I'm the problem is every time I hear Born to Be Wild, I have to shut it off in the car. Because the first thing that happens is everything in my rearview mirror gets really small.
Oh, yeah, I know.
It just happens. You know, I'm sitting there, and, man, my foot just hits the pedal. And it's like I just hope there's no cops around because it happens every time, every single time.
I wind up seat dancing. I do. I'm in there just diddy bopping in my seat, you know, and people drive by me and they look at me and they go, what the hell?
I have trouble keeping my hands on the wheel because I'm playing the drums.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, we're driver drummers. That's what we are. Okay. Well, for Bob Brill and myself, Jim Christina, and our ever missing Bobby Jean Bell, we have Shot Another Thursday right in the butt, and we are out of here.